Bloomberg Audio Studios. Podcasts, radio, news. You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
A very busy day here in Washington, a busy day specifically for the president, who is heading right now from the White House to Capitol Hill for lunch with Senate Republicans. That is likely to be testy, only to head back to the White House a few hours from now for another meeting that is set to be testy with the NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte. Then, of course, he will have his celebratory America 250, Freedom 250 rally on the National Mall this evening. What we didn't know was going to be on the president's schedule today until yesterday was a bill signing of the 21st Century Road to Housing Act. He announced he would be signing it at the Capitol tomorrow. The White House press office was heralding this. Lawmakers were heralding it as a big bipartisan breakthrough and win on Capitol Hill, something we rarely see these days. And then this morning, of course, Joe, President Trump says the signing is canceled.
Yeah.
And he will not sign that legislation until the Save America Act is passed.
Today's housing news conference, he writes, and signing is hereby canceled until such time as we pass the desperately needed Save America Act. Kaylee, the Sharpies were laid out. Mm-hmm. The cameras were on the stand.
The stage was
reporters
literally set.
Were there. The stage was literally set. The leaders were at the altar. It's not often, if ever, we've heard of something like this happening. And that doesn't mean that the bill dies here,
no.
Right? If it's if he doesn't do anything for 10 days, it becomes law. And he's not threatening to veto it. But this really adds to the angst on Capitol Hill. And we start there with Tyler Kendall, who's on the north lawn of the White House right now. The president's motorcade just passed behind her as he makes his way up to the Hill. What was the motivator here, Tyler? We had a ceremony set. Did something happen this morning that changed the president's mind?
Well, Joe, at this point, it appears very evident that there has been mounting frustration, I think it's fair to say, for months from President Trump as he tries to get the Save America Act over the finish line. But we've repeatedly heard from Republican leaders, including this morning, that there just isn't the votes there, that the math doesn't work out. In fact, Senate Majority Leader John Thune, speaking to reporters within the last hour, said that it's clear that, quote, no doubt the president has got a lot of input, but ultimately he thinks that the president wants to eliminate the filibuster in order to get this done, and there's not going to be votes for that either, because as you were mentioning at the top of the program, in order for this to actually get done, you would very likely need 60 votes in the Senate, which means Democrats would have to get on board, which doesn't seem likely, let alone all Republicans, as some have expressed concerns over this legislation that would seek to tighten voter registration and casting of ballots. Now, we'll have to see where it goes from here. The House Speaker Mike Johnson said earlier today that he does expect President Trump to actually put his signature to this legislation, considering that it passed with such broad bipartisan support. It was highly anticipated. And this is an issue, Joe and Kaylee, that we know both parties are trying to stake their claim to when it comes to affordability as we get closer to November.
Well, of course, the president has cast some doubt on that affordability narrative and suggested that this bill, ultimately this housing bill that lawmakers are so celebrating, is insignificant. So what does this reveal, Tyler, about the president's priorities ahead of November, as he's obviously about to go meet with lawmakers whose priorities may look slightly different?
That's a really good point. And we can say, just on the housing bill quickly, industry analysts have told us that there is this potential that this bill would have at least a delayed or a muted impact. One, because it doesn't include any new funding that we know many advocates in the industry wanted to see. And it's harder for the federal government to streamline regulations if they're coming from the local level. But it is very clear that Republicans want to focus in on an economic message, as affordability remains the top concern for American voters. And we saw President Trump nod to that yesterday, of course, visiting the critical battleground state of Pennsylvania for the fifth time so far this second term. But President Trump has really been pushing, of course, his foreign policy agenda. And perhaps that could be another instance where we see some tension on Capitol Hill later today after that rare rebuke from the Senate passing after 10 times of voting that war powers resolution that seeks to rein in and curb President Trump when it comes to the conflict in Iran. This is another instance where the White House has dismissed this. Of course, the vote is largely symbolic, and the White House has chalked it up to essentially an accounting error here, because two senators, Mitch McConnell and Dave McCormick, weren't there, and that's ultimately what ended up tipping the voting in favor against President Trump. So definitely some heated exchanges that we're expecting later today, though also, of course, perhaps it could be a rallying moment. We'll have to see where it ultimately goes from here.
To be a fly on the wall. He should be rolling up just about now to the carriage entrance, Tyler. I've got to ask you about his nighttime plans, though. Big MAGA rally on the National Mall, 8:30 p.m. This was originally supposed to be a concert with the likes of Martina McBride, Bret Michaels, the Commodores, Milli Vanilli, all of whom canceled when they came to learn that this was a political event. So the president will be there this evening. Lee Greenwood, I guess, is going to be singing to us. But what's the point of this whole rally when we're in the District of Columbia if this is a campaign-style event?
Well, Joe, at this point, it's supposed to kick off the 250th anniversary celebrations that we know that this White House has been really gearing up for. It coincides with the National State Fair, where we're seeing all these different states come to the nation's capital and tout some of the key priorities of their states as part of this. Some states have chosen not to participate, which is another matter in and of itself. But we are expecting President Trump to really use this as a campaign-style address to the American people. We'll have to see where he ultimately goes from here, because yesterday in his Pennsylvania address, we saw him hit on multiple topics, and he's going to be fresh off of his meeting at the White House with the NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte. So I would expect some foreign policy to probably come into his remarks tonight, since it will be likely top of mind, and President Trump's, as he calls it, America First agenda is going to be very much at the forefront of that conversation amid what has been his intense criticism of the NATO alliance.
All right, Bloomberg's Tyler Kendall live at the White House. Thank you so much. So perhaps it is foreign policy that will be top of mind for the president this evening, but top of mind right now, it likely is legislation on Capitol Hill that he would like to see pass. He's walking into a meeting now with Senate Republicans. He's going to be attending lunch. You see him for our audience on Bloomberg TV. He is walking right next to the Senate Majority Leader, John Thune, whose job has been made very difficult by the demands and frequent surprises of the president. It seems like the president is talking. Let's listen.
Very powerful. It's going very, very well. Go ahead.
Buying a home is unattainable for so many Americans. Is this election legislation more important to you than resolving the housing crisis?
This is every election is important. We're doing very well. They want a lot of communists to come in. I'm saying it a little bit differently, but the people that they're pushing our communists, and this country is not going to have communists. Thank you very much.
There you have it. President Trump was just asked there about the prioritizing of election-related legislation over affordability legislation, and you just heard his answer. And clearly, Joe, he had already made that clear earlier today when he said he wouldn't be signing this housing affordability bill. Instead, wants to see the Save America Act passed.
Of course, no communists were involved. They're self-described socialist Democrats, three of whom won with the backing of Mayor Mamdani last evening, which has created a new narrative for Republicans to seize on. Not surprising to hear him make those remarks, but just imagine what's going through John Thune's head right now. As you pointed out, this is someone who's had the rug pulled out from under him by this president multiple times, and now they're going behind closed doors.
Yeah, he has said publicly, repeatedly, that the votes are not there for the Save America Act or to kill the filibuster in order to get the Save America Act done. So how much will he be reiterating a message we've been hearing for months again today? And of course, what might the president say in return about doing it through other means, like reconciliation 3.0? So on that note, we turn to Jonathan Tamari, who covers Congress for us through Bloomberg Government, where he's a senior Washington reporter. So, Jonathan, we heard the House Speaker Mike Johnson say reconciliation 3.0 is how you get this done. We're going to pursue it in the House. What is the likelihood that that effort can be successful, that this even will be considered a budgetary matter?
It seems very unlikely, to be honest with you. I mean, there's a very tenuous budget connection, and as you know, reconciliation bills have to be fiscally related, so the connection there is very tenuous. Even if it was somehow added to the package and ruled in order, there's a lot of obstacles. Remember, it took Republicans 6 months last year to pass their tax cuts, which is something that really united the party. They're talking about trying to do a third reconciliation bill here within a matter of 2 to 3 months on a topic that divides a lot of the party, that the president obviously is not fully bought in on this process because he keeps undercutting Republicans here on the Hill. So I think the odds are extremely long that they get another reconciliation bill done this year before Election Day.
So what's the point of this meeting then? Is this simply an airing of grievances, as Mike Dorning put it earlier? This is a festivus for the rest of us, or could there be an agreement when lawmakers leave the room today with Donald Trump on any number of things, including extending FISA 702?
Well, I think you never rule anything out with the president. You know that he loves to come out and announce big deals and agreements. But I think most likely it is the former. It is an airing of the grievances of the president expressing his frustration that a Republican majority is not moving a bill that he sees as a priority. And Republicans have made it clear that they think he's undercutting their priorities and particularly undercutting their efforts to hold on to their majorities in the Senate and the House. That they're here, they want to talk about affordability. John Thune all week has been trying to talk about affordability and talk about this housing bill as an example of what they're doing for regular Americans. And here the president has stepped all over it. So I think both sides are going to have some grievances. It seems unlikely that they'll come to a deal today, but you obviously never know with the president.
Well, so I wonder, Jonathan, if you expect that we'll hear from senators about what happened in the room today and who you would expect to be most vocal inside the room and out of it, as we consider, for example, the four senators who were willing to vote against the president on the War Powers resolution last night.
Yeah, I think the question of who's vocal in the room and out is going to be slightly different. I think that some senators might feel more comfortable speaking up in private and might not say that as publicly. I think some of those senators who have already lost their reelection bids or who are retiring and have nothing to lose will be more clear, and they have been more clear going into the election. Senator John Cornyn, who, of course, Trump endorsed against in Texas and who lost his primary, said that he plans to ask the president, whether he really cares about the midterms, that he plans to tell him that some of these actions that he's doing are hurting Republicans' chances of holding their majority. So he's somebody who I think will feel more comfortable speaking out. I think a lot of other comments will probably be kept in the room or attempted to be kept in the room, because still most Republicans don't want to cross the president in public, as frustrated as they are. But Thune wants other people to speak up. He says, I've delivered the message, and I need other people to make it clear. It's not just me making this up, that is kind of where the conference is.
Boy, they do have a lot on the menu that they could be talking about here, Jonathan Tamari. It's kind of incredible to think of how long the list has gotten. But if we're moving beyond things like the anti-weaponization fund, and the matter of Bill Pulte, I suspect, will still come up here. Will there be a conversation about the president supporting candidates on the midterm trail?
I think that it's more likely to focus on legislation. I think that Republicans realize the president is going to endorse who he wants to endorse. And I think mm-hmm. that many, if not all, of the biggest Republican primaries have passed where there's real challenges. I think they're mostly focused on things like affordability, the housing bill, FISA legislation, the head of the Office of National Intelligence are the things that I think you're going to hear from senators more specifically today.
I think that's probably enough. Jonathan, thank you. Reporting for Bloomberg Government live on Capitol Hill, Jonathan Tamari, we appreciate it.
Stay with us on Balance of Power. We'll have much more coming up after this.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
We add the voice of a Republican member of the House conference, Mike Lawler, from the 17th District of New York. Mr. Salt is back with us live here on Bloomberg TV and radio. And Congressman, it's good to have you back. Thanks for joining. I'm trying to tamp down the noise and get to the actual news here for our audience. Is the fact that the president is not suggesting a veto here only means that we've canceled a ceremony And that voters and investors can count on this bill becoming law within the next 10 days?
Yeah, I think this bill is going to become law. I think there are major wins in here for the American people. Housing is one of the biggest issues that we can tackle as a country when it comes to the issue of affordability. Most people's wealth is invested in their home. The average age of a first-time homebuyer is 40 years old. We are 8 million units underbuilt nationwide. And obviously, during the Biden administration, we saw the 30-year fixed interest mortgage rate reach 30-year record highs. So, you know, we are working to address housing in a bipartisan way. I mean, overwhelming bipartisan majorities in both the House and the Senate. Obviously, the president and the Senate Republican conference have some issues they need to work through. But from my vantage point, this bill needs to be signed, needs to become law, and I'm confident it will.
So is the order of priority here out of line for the president, Congressman? If you say this needs to be addressed, this affordability concern for voters, does election voter ID legislation not deserve to rank so highly?
Well, look, Congress deals with a multitude of issues on any given week. I mean, we vote on dozens of bills. So obviously the president has...
But the president is suggesting that there is an order of priority.
Let me finish. Okay, let me finish. The president has a priority that he has put on the table with the Senate for months. The Senate rules have obviously impeded the ability to pass that. And that's, you know, for the Senate and the president to work out. And that's why they're meeting today. But fundamentally, to me, getting this housing bill passed and signed into law has been a priority. I've been leading in this effort since coming to Congress. Six of my bills were part of the final package of the larger housing plan. And so, you know, this is something that I think is going to have a profoundly positive impact on the economy as we move forward, bringing down cost, increasing supply, cutting barriers to construction, increasing access to capital, preventing, you know, large institutional investors from gobbling up single family residential housing supply. So there are a lot of positive wins here that I think will ultimately impact the economy in a very positive way. You know, the day-to-day bubble of Washington that, you know, we get caught up in or you guys focus on ultimately, you know, isn't going to matter. The bill is going to become law.
Mm-hmm. That's what we're trying to arrive at, Congressman. Does that mean that the Save America Act also will, but at a later time?
Look, we'll see what comes out of the conversation with the Senate and the president on that issue. Obviously, you know, Reconciliation 3.0 is something that's on the table. I know the president has talked about the Senate filibuster, you know, as another issue. All of these issues matter, and they're all stuff that Congress will work through. But the housing bill is passed, and it's going to be signed into law.
Well, on Reconciliation 3.0, and we heard the speaker talk about this earlier, Congressman, suggesting the House is going to push ahead with it and try to have the Save America Act included, or at least have grants associated with it included. How heavy of a lift is that going to be? What actual odds would you put around Reconciliation 3.0 passing both chambers?
Well, look, I think a big part of this is defining what is in it. You know, addressing a supplemental for the military, dealing with waste, fraud, and abuse within the federal government, addressing housing, healthcare, you know, energy. Are critical. Those are discussions that are underway, and we will see what ultimately would be in a proposed package and whether or not, you know, that can garner the support within the House and the Senate, and certainly in a time frame that we're operating on before the midterms, or whether this is something that would, you know, be looked at after.
quite a night in New York with the primaries, Congressman. We've got two more socialists going to Congress. Mayor Mamdani made three endorsements. All three of them won. And I'm wondering if you're looking at this as a Manhattan project, if you will, or a national trend.
Look, I think if you go back to Bernie Sanders' campaign in 2016 through today, the Democratic Party has shifted towards Bernie Sanders. And the issues that he ran on are very much the mainstream platform of the Democratic Party today. And when you look at Zohran Mamdani's election last November, and subsequently these primary elections, not just in New York, but in Maine, in California, what's happening in Michigan, in New Jersey, Democratic socialists are winning. They are capturing the base of the party and the momentum. And it very much is clear that Hakeem Jeffries has no ability to control the conference or the party. Neither does Chuck Schumer, for that matter. And that Zohran Mamdani, along with AOC and Bernie Sanders, very much are in control, not just of the message, but in terms of the electorate of the Democratic Party. And so I think this is a much bigger issue than Democrats want to let on. I think most of them are petrified of losing these primaries. Jeffries effectively cut a deal with Mamdani to avoid a primary of his own yesterday, but pretty much threw everybody else under the bus as sacrificial lambs. And, you know, I think it is extremely destructive. And every Democrat running in a competitive district, including in mine, is going to have to answer for it, because you can't just say, oh, that's not me. If you win, you're empowering these crazy people. And that's a big problem.
Well, is it really fair to put your opponent, who you now know will be Kate Conley, in the same bucket as people who are self-proclaimed Democratic socialists, the likes of AOC and Bernie Sanders? This is a more moderate individual, is it not?
Why not? You guys have spent 10 years putting Republicans in every bucket with the president. They have to answer for the positions of their party. And the fact is, if they win and they get control of the majority, these people are going to be driving the policy agenda. And so, yes, they do have to answer for it. And yes, they do have to say where they stand on it. And yes, they do have to say whether or not they agree with Zohran Mamdani and whether or not they agree with these socialist candidates being at the forefront of policy in Washington and in Albany. It wasn't just the three congressional seats yesterday. You had numerous incumbent state legislators taken out by socialist Democrats running to be in the state Senate and in the state assembly. And no, my opponent is not a moderate. The fact is, she has said at no point any issue in which she would buck her party or work across the aisle or work with the president, frankly. I have a record of bipartisan accomplishment. I have a record of being effective and actually delivering bipartisan results, agreeing with the president at times, and also pushing back on the president. You don't just get to claim the mantle of moderation in comparison to the avowed socialists when, in fact, you have the same exact policy positions. Kate Conley wants to abolish ICE. Kate Conley wants to raise taxes on hardworking New Yorkers. She was opposed to the working families tax cut package. She was in favor of allowing illegal immigrants to collect health care benefits. So you claiming that she's a moderate, based on what?
Well, because she is not a Democratic socialist or has not openly subscribed to some of those ideas.
Is that the new standard? Is that the new standard? You're a moderate if you're not a socialist? I mean, look.
Well, no, I am just saying that you were speaking about Democratic socialists and that your opponent is not.
Which is further to the left. I mean, look at Dan Goldman. Dan Goldman lost yesterday. Dan Goldman is not a moderate. Dan Goldman is a progressive Democrat. Adriano Espaillat is a progressive Democrat. You know, Antonio Reynoso, who lost in Nydia Velazquez's seat, is a progressive Democrat. These aren't moderates. The fact is, the socialist is further to the left, sure, but they're not moderates. And Kate Conley is not a moderate either.
All right, Congressman, it's good to have you back. I do think, though, we can just, between you and I, acknowledge the fact that at Bloomberg, we do try to bring a range of voices on here, and we have never suggested that all Republicans are Donald Trump. But we'd love to talk to you.
No, but
you guys
do continually ask every Republican candidate anything President Trump says or does. It's fair then to say to the Democrats, well, where do you stand on these people? That's a fair question. If you've done it for 10 years against Republicans, get ready to start doing it against Democrats with respect to Zohran Mamdani.
We did do it for 4 years when President Biden was president.
I tried to, that's for sure.
But Congressman, we appreciate you joining us. The Congressman from the 17th District of New York, Mike Lawler, with us here on Bloomberg TV and radio. All right, let's talk to both a Democrat and a Republican at the same
time, shall we, Joe? You said it. We've got a political panel and a good one for you here. Roger Fisk has been listening, of course, our Democratic strategist, a former aide to President Obama, senior advisor, Burway Group, and Rosemary Becky has had an ear on our conversation as well, partner at Brownstein Hyatt, our Republican strategist. It's great to have you both with us. We were going to get to some other topics here, but this is pretty hot right now. We may as well stick with it. Roger, I'll start with you. You heard everything that the congressman said, and Republicans are painting a picture here of a wild left socialist wing of the Democratic Party that's sweeping the nation. Is what happened in downtown Manhattan going to take place coast to coast?
Well, the difference is that what the congressman was positing was putting Mamdani into the presidency is essentially what he was doing, when in fact what you all have been doing for 10 years is asking Republicans to respond to what President Trump did. No Democrat running in Oregon or Florida is beholden to whatever the mayor of New York or the mayor of any other place said. So that I found that to be kind of a flawed premise of how he was going about things. But I do think you can imagine the editing suites right now. Last time I was here was right after the "I don't care about inflation" comment. So I want to be fair. You can you could just picture the editing suites of the negative ads about the president being made, and you can splice together a very effective negative ad from some of the victory speeches of these folks who won the primaries last night. So it's going to be difficult for folks in every other district than where they're at. And back on the congressman's point about his opponent as well, that's what you're going to see is them trying to take essentially a square peg and shove it into a round hole and say that no matter who you are, no matter what where you're running, no matter what you're running for, I'm going to try to force you to go up or down on this Mamdani question. And I get that, but I think any agile politician would see that for what it is and adjust accordingly and not get bogged down in comparing themselves to some mayor that in many cases is thousands of miles from wherever they are an elected official.
Well, so Rosemary, I would love your take here because the congressman did make a fair point that often elected officials or those running for elected office have to answer for whoever it is at the top of their party. That is the case for President Trump, and it was the case when Joe Biden was president and historically for generations before that. Is there a fair equation, though, to make right now between what the Republican Party is to MAGA and what democratic socialism currently is to the wider Democratic Party? Is it really as powerful a force?
So I think what the congressman was trying to say, and I think the point that's trying to be made is when you elect these ultra progressive, factions or even ultra conservative fractions, excuse me, they influence, right, the party, and they influence legislation, and they are part of the process. So when you're passing a bill or you're in committee, I mean, they have influence, right? And I think that that's his point, and the fact that he feels that that Democrats will have to answer it to it because those socialists are going to have a voice in Congress going forward. So I think it's true on both sides, to be honest, right? Like those extremes influence what happens in Washington. And right now we've got that, right? We've got a whole lot of gridlock going on because we've got a lot of different factions that are duking it out right now.
the statement from the spokesperson at the NRCC tonight was not just a bad night for so-called leader Hakeem Jeffries. Mike Marinella writes, it was the night the Democrat establishment officially surrendered to Zohran Mamdani. The president had said weeks ago, when he had a visit in the Oval Office with Mamdani, that you're the leader of the Democratic Party. Does this argument highlight the fact that there is not a leader of the Democratic Party?
In some ways, absolutely. And it's also the most recent, right? So we're immersed in recency bias right here. But one of the things that the Republicans have been successful in doing is, for example, if you polled many Republicans, you would get them to actually say that the Green New Deal was an actual legislative package that was passed and is now law. When in fact it was never a legitimate legislative vehicle at all. Small elements of it were taken up in infrastructure bills and some other things in the Biden administration, but it did become an extremely effective brush with which Republicans painted candidates, especially in primaries, as saying they're going to come in and do the Green New Deal. And so there's an element of jujitsu going on here. But I get it. I would, if I worked at the NRCC, I would not leave anything on the table. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, it's on a platter. Like, I get it. Mm-hmm.
Well, so for the NRCC, as we get to the crux of where the conversation began, Rosemary, about Republicans now pointing to what happened in New York and saying, look, this is where the entire Democratic Party is going. Does this make it easier in some swing districts for Republicans to win their reelections or to flip seats, knowing that there are other headwinds to consider, like an unpopular war in Iran, like ongoing questions around affordability, where even bipartisan efforts to address affordability aren't necessarily being seen to completion, at least today, if the president won't sign the bill?
Look, I think this is an opportunity for Republicans. I think the Republicans need to really talk about affordability and talk about solutions, you know, talk about ideas about, you know, how do we improve housing? How do we lower energy costs, right? And start to address those issues and address them by saying higher taxes and more spending isn't the answer, right? That there's other better solutions out there. And so I think it's an opportunity. And I think that the Republicans need to hone in on that, because at the end of the day, and I think we saw this in 2025, it is about affordability, right? Americans are feeling the pinch, you know, whether it's energy costs, whether it's at the grocery store, healthcare costs, they are feeling the pinch. And so I think Republicans have to be out there talking about the solutions. Mm-hmm.
Great panel. Rosemary, we thank you. Rosemary Becky and Roger Fisk. Great insights after a doozy of an interview. I need to go get a glass of water or something. Can we breathe? We'll be back with much more as the president prepares to meet with the Secretary General of NATO in the next couple of hours.
Stay with us on Balance of Power. We'll have much more coming up after this.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
We are considering a busy day on both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue. Right now, as we speak, President Trump is in the luncheon with Senate Republicans, having walked in right next to the Senate Majority Leader, John Thune. And we know a number of items are going to be on that agenda, including, of course, the Save America Act, which the president wants passed before he signs the housing bill he was supposed to sign today. FISA, the war with Iran, likely to be a focus as well. And once he's through all of that, he's going to head back to the White House, where he will be meeting, scheduled to be at 3:30 p.m., but we'll see how on time that is, with the Secretary General of NATO, Mark Rutte. And on that agenda, of course, the war between Russia and Ukraine and questions around the U.S.'s commitment to the alliance, and specifically the troops that the U.S. currently has committed to NATO countries in Europe, and whether or not they will be moved around or withdrawn completely.
A lot of contentious meetings for him potentially today. Yep. Unclear if this will be or not, but it's going to be a big ask for Mark Rutte to square the circle on all of this. The president was talking about NATO and what he believes is our troubled past just yesterday in the Oval Office. Listen.
We have been a great member of NATO. In many ways,
certainly the predominant member. The numbers that we spend are so crazy on NATO, and they weren't there for us. We spend all of this money, and then when we want to maybe have help on small stuff, this is small time. This is not the big one. This is small potatoes. They say no, we'd rather not help. Stupid thing to say.
We'll see what they say today, as we're joined now by Jennifer DeLuey, Bloomberg News White House correspondent, has just come out to the North Lawn to spend some time with us. Jen, it's great to see you. What's going to happen inside this meeting, and will there be cameras allowed inside?
The million-dollar question always here at the White House. Yeah. You know, right now it's technically closed press on the president's public schedule. We'll see if it opens up. That often happens. You know, it's not clear whether we're going to see fireworks either. Clearly, the Secretary General of NATO is coming here on a mission to continue to build and foster, you know, his already really warm relations with the president, maybe to diffuse mm-hmm. some of the tensions that you just saw in that clip of the president yesterday. You know, President Trump has been extremely critical in recent weeks and months about, you know, what he complains as a lack of support from NATO allies during the war with Iran. He says, you know, they didn't allow use of military bases to support the operation in Iran. He complains that they didn't help open the Strait of Hormuz by force. And now the U.S. has launched a review of essentially its European military assets, its support for NATO that is causing a lot of heartache and heartburn for European allies who are bracing for potentially deep cuts. So Ruta's coming here with a mission, I think, to head some of that off, to try to speak directly to what he considers a friend in President Trump and encourage him to continue support for the alliance, but also continue support for Ukraine through military sales, et cetera.
Well, and Jen, remind us how much of that is really at the president's discretion and his administration's discretion alone. How much, when it comes to NATO, is actually a decision making that has to run through Congress?
Well, full withdrawal is obviously not something that he can do independently. But, you know, the president can make life hard for NATO allies. He certainly can pull down a good deal of the U.S. posture overseas. And this military review that Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has embarked on, which will take 6 months, is, you know, setting the stage for some potentially serious cuts. So that's what is causing a fair amount of concern right now. You know, even if the president can't do everything he might want to do to retaliate or constrain NATO, he can still make life difficult for allies overseas.
All right, Jennifer DeLuey, Bloomberg News White House correspondent on the North Lawn for us today. Jen, thank you so much. And for more, as we continue this conversation, we turn to a former U.S. ambassador to NATO. Ambassador Ivo Dodler is with us now, senior fellow at the Harvard Belfer Center, having served in that role in the ambassador role under President Obama. Ambassador, welcome back to Bloomberg TV and radio. I wonder how easy or difficult you expect this meeting to be for Mark Rutte specifically, who has in the past had a very warm relationship with President Trump. I would remind our audience that he once referred to him as daddy. And I just wonder how warm you expect this to be today.
You know, I think on a personal level, the president and the secretary general get on very well. And as President Trump said, people who like me, I like people who like me. Mr. Rutte has done whatever he can to demonstrate that he likes President Trump. He's gone bent over backwards. He has, for many European leaders, gone too far in doing so. But he doesn't have a political constituency other than those leaders who are also interested in keeping the United States on board. But it's not just about this meeting. It really is about the nature and the way in this that this alliance is going to move forward. In less than 2 weeks, all 32 leaders are going to be in Ankara for a NATO summit. And what President Trump will do at that summit is the big question that Mr. Rutte is going to ask him. He wants to make sure that the summit doesn't blow up, that there aren't real fundamental big differences. We saw in the G7 that it worked pretty well, and hopefully it will work well in Ankara as well. But there's some really serious issues that the president will want to raise, and frankly, that the Europeans are raising.
How do we define the summit blowing up, Ambassador? I know that Pete Hegseth has announced this extended review of U.S. forces across Europe. president's taken 5,000 troops out of Germany. Are these the kind of ideas that could blow up a NATO summit?
Well, that could be. The president could walk out. He can legally withdraw from NATO is, in fact, a constitutional question that hasn't been answered. But he can certainly tell the NATO leaders that, as president, he's not particularly prepared to defend them, which is pretty much the same thing. So that's what blowing up means. But even if that doesn't happen, and I don't think that's going to happen, there are some serious issues that are on the table, not only the 5,000 troops out of Germany that you mentioned. I think much more worrisome was the announcement a few weeks ago that the United States will not contribute to what is called the NATO force model. Those are the forces that are going to be available in 10, 30, and 300 days in case of a major conflict. And the U.S. is significantly reducing its commitment, particularly of air power, a number of air wings, a number of airplanes that are dedicated to that mission are going to be cut by a third. The number of refuelers, those are the aircraft that refuel in the air, bombers and fighters and the like, are going to be cut by half. The intelligence and surveillance systems that the United States almost uniquely possesses are going to be cut as well. And so, rather, instead of doing this in a slow and methodical way, as Europe builds up, the U.S. can reduce its capability, which is something that everyone in Europe wants to do. The U.S. has now announced they're going to do it immediately. If tomorrow there's a war, those forces that were available 4 weeks ago would not be available today. That is a major, major decision, which suggests that the United States is disengaging from Europe, or at least less engaged in Europe than it has been any time in the last 76 years.
Well, and of course, that's an important consideration for wars of the future, potentially. But what about the war of the present on the European continent, Ambassador? As we consider the current state of play between Russia and Ukraine, where we actually have seen Ukrainian advances, seen successful Ukrainian attacks on Moscow, for example, do you sense that there is a tide shifting there and that the president may actually want to ride a winning Ukrainian tide, a Ukrainian wave, more so than he previously seemed that he had a desire to do?
Well, wouldn't that be nice? That would be certainly a shift. But the president, consistency is not necessarily high on the agenda. So I think the idea of him supporting a winning ticket is perhaps attractive. And you're right. The military balance inside Ukraine and in this war is slowly but surely shifting because of two fundamental changes. Number one is that the Russians are running out of manpower. Believe it or not, they're four times bigger in terms of personnel than the Ukrainians, but they haven't mobilized the country because Vladimir Putin is not at war with Ukraine. He is engaged in a, quote, special military operation. He doesn't want to mobilize because that would undermine his domestic support for this war. And as a result, he's been paying a lot of people to go to the front, and the number of casualties that are now suffering on the front line by the Russians are higher than the number of troops that are being replaced each month. So the situation is getting worse. So is the economic situation for Russia, and that is a one part of it. The second part of it is the Ukrainians, through drones and other strikes, are becoming increasingly able to hit the Russians both deep inside Russia, beyond the battlefield, and now to cut off Crimea from Russian support, particularly oil and other logistical support. So the war is churning, and if the president wants to jump on a winning bandwagon, he's a way to do that. He could call Vladimir Putin and say, you know what, you're losing this war. You're not getting the right kind of information from your generals. Here's the information that we have about what the state of the war is, and share some of the intelligence information that we have about it in order to convince Vladimir Putin that his choice is to stop now and keep at least for now what he has, or suffer a worse defeat.
Well, you wonder if he might be motivated to take that posture after spending some time with allies at the NATO summit, Ambassador. When Bloomberg News wrote up a story about today's meeting with the Secretary General, we spoke to a number of lawmakers, Democrats and Republicans, including Democratic Senator Brian Schatz. And his comment jumps off the page. This president, he said, is uniquely misaligned with the Western world, and I'm not sure that's fixable with a White House visit. Do you agree?
Yeah, I think there's a major breach in the relationship between Europe and the United States. I think this is the worst crisis among many crises that are have been there for the last 80 years. This is by far the worst. Europeans are distrustful of the United States. Only 11% of European publics now think that the United States is an ally. That is astonishing when you think about it. More see the United States as a rival than as a friend or a partner. Those are very worrisome signs. And the same is true on for Washington, which is now basically decided that because the Europeans weren't willing to support the United States in a war on which they were neither consulted nor thought was necessary, for conclusions that, by the way, they were right on, that therefore there is no value to NATO. That's what the Secretary of State is saying. That's what the Secretary of Defense is saying. It's what the President is saying. So under those circumstances, yes, we are in a misalignment. That's a nice way of putting it. We are in a deep crisis in this alliance, and it's not going to be fixed by one visit. It's frankly not going to be fixed by one summit, and it may not even be fixed by a change in administration.
Wow. In our final moment, Ambassador, do you think it could have been fixed by European allies being more willing to intervene in the Strait of Hormuz?
No, I don't really think so. I think if the Europeans had supported the United States, we would have still been where we are, which is that the United States way overestimated its own military power and way underestimated the capacity of the Iranians to resist in this situation. So I think we would have been in the same place, except that the U.S. would continue to blame the Europeans for a mistake that the United States made, which was to start this war from the beginning.
Really appreciate the time, Ambassador. Ahead of Donald Trump's meeting with the NATO Secretary General Ivo Dalder, former U.S. Ambassador to NATO in the Obama administration. Thanks for being back with us on Bloomberg TV and radio. Kaylee, we're seeing real destruction here in the markets, turning not only below our highs of the day, but in fact negative in terms of the S&P 500, now down 12 points, the NASDAQ down almost 100, fractions, but still lower. And look at Bitcoin.
Unbelievable.
We've got a 59 handle.
Yeah, we've broken below $60,000. This is the lowest level since going back before the election, September of 2024. Yeah. That entire post-election bounce has been erased. So we'll continue to follow that for you here on Bloomberg TV and radio. This is Balance of Power.
Thanks for listening to the Balance of Power podcast. Make sure to subscribe if you haven't already at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find us live every weekday from Washington, D.C. at noontime Eastern at Bloomberg.com.